Can Tai Chi help with knee osteoarthritis?
Are we screening the right people for lung cancer?
Physicians asking about guns in the home.
And a heart attack with no symptoms.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on May 20th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences System in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And just back from Italy, and just so happy to be back in the saddle, huh, Rick?
And back in Texas, and as you say, in the saddle.
Let's start this week with this longstanding issue, one that we actually have talked about before. In Annals of Internal Medicine, physicians asking about guns in the home. This, of course, a huge public health issue. In some states, anyway, physicians have been under a gag order not to ask about weapons in the home.
And that has particularly reared its head in the state of Florida, where there has been a gag order where physicians are not supposed to ask parents whether they have guns in the home when the pediatricians are trying to make sure that it's safe. Because there are almost 33,000 gun deaths in the United States, many of them due to mishaps or to suicides. From a physician's standpoint, we're interested in knowing about guns, not because we care about guns or gun control, but because we're concerned about patient safety and public health as well. So this is a paper that summarized a number of things. Is it actually prohibitive for physicians to ask about firearms when that information is relevant to the health of the patient or others? And the answer to that is there is no prohibition if it directly impacts upon either the patient's health or the public health. If the patient expresses suicidal or homicidal thoughts or ideations, if there are individual risk factors, for example, the patient has a history of violence or drug or alcohol abuse or serious mental illness, and if they're a member of a demographic group that is an increased risk of violence either to themselves or to others, for example, middle-aged and older white men, 5 times more likely to be involved with gun-related issues, young African-American men, children and adolescents. Under these circumstances, there is no prohibition on asking about guns. But many physicians feel uncomfortable because once they've asked about them, what recommendations do you make? For that, the mnemonic to remember is we ask about the 5 L's. Locked, loaded, little children, feeling low, or learned owner. Is it locked? Is it loaded? Is it around little children? Feeling low is, does the person have feeling of depression? And is the owner learned in gun safety?
I am interested in an estimation, and I'm sure it's not in this paper, of if these criteria were applied to the population of people who died, let's say last year, in the last several years, relative to gun violence, I wonder what percentage of those may have been avoided if they had been applied.
Your question is excellent because what the gun rights individuals say, well, there's no evidence that's suggesting that doing this actually makes things safer. And the authors of this study are honest about it and said, well, we don't have good data because it's not been studied. And part of that, as you and I know, is there's been a prohibition on studying this. But what they can point to is when people have asked about this and addressed it, there is a higher likelihood that those guns will in fact be locked or taken away from children. So that's a surrogate endpoint. But as you mentioned, we don't have good studies about this.
Right, and that's going to, of course, require federal action.
And for a lot of reasons, federal funding has not been forthcoming because that's been blocked by many groups. To me, that is a travesty. We should all be wanting to do things based upon evidence and information, and we have to get that information, and that's done through well-designed studies.
We will keep hoping. Since we're in Annals of Internal Medicine, then let's turn to something that's relevant to me anyway, with knee osteoarthritis. Does physical therapy or Tai Chi help to manage that condition?
Tai Chi has been shown to have a number of different beneficial effects. And let me take a step back and say, for those not familiar with it, it's a multi-component traditional Chinese mind-body practice, and it combines meditation with very slow and gentle and graceful movements, deep breathing and relaxation. We've talked before about how it's particularly helpful in older individuals with their strength and conditioning. It decreases falls. It improves their mobility. The question is, for people that have knee osteoarthritis and have difficulty with movement, is it beneficial? And what would be the comparator? Well, the comparator would be physical therapy, because that's really one of the most effective ways we have of treating knee osteoarthritis. These investigators took over 200 individuals that had symptomatic knee osteoarthritis, average age of about 60, and they submitted to either 12 weeks of standard physical therapy or 12 weeks of Tai Chi. where they met two times per week for an hour, and then they followed them for up to a year. And what they discovered was that with both therapies, the symptoms improved, and the symptoms improved similarly. The individuals that did practice Tai Chi, however, had a greater improvement in depression and the physical component of the quality of life. And the nice thing about it is it's inexpensive, and there's no ill side effects associated with it. In my opinion, it's a very good alternative to people that have knee osteoarthritis, as good an alternative as standard physical therapy.
I'm wondering about the additive effects of physical therapy and Tai Chi.
Interesting thought that wasn't studied in this particular investigation, but it really makes you wonder if either of them are effective, would they be better combined? That's
Indeed.
A great question.
Yeah, maybe I'll try it myself and I'll report anecdotally. Let's turn now to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Yet another one of those ongoing issues, USPSTF recommendations on former smokers, current smokers, how they should be screened for lung cancer. What are we doing now?
This was a very fascinating study, because on the one hand, we want to screen for cancers that we know that early detection might allow you to treat and to save lives. And we've talked before about the fact that lung cancer screening for individuals that have smoked for 30 pack years or more between the ages of 55 to 80 and either current smokers or have smoked in the last 15 years, that cancer screening with CT increases the risk of detecting cancer and actually can improve early detection and lower mortality. However, that's really not personalized medicine. Within that group of individuals, there's some that are low risk. There's some individuals that wouldn't be recommended for routine screening. For example, somebody that had 25 pack years of smoking and was a 65-year-old African-American woman. Her risk is high, but she wouldn't be included in the routine screening. So what these authors did was they went back to some of the previous observational studies looking at various types of cancer and develop a model based upon some of the common demographic things: age, education, what is their gender, smoking intensity, what was the duration and their BMI, family history. And they put that into a model. And they tested that, said if I had 9 million individuals and subjected them to CT scan versus this risk assessment, which would be better at finding cancer? Using the factors I mentioned, was much better at detecting it. It included individuals that wouldn't be screened with CT recommendations by the USPSTF. There were fewer people needed to be screened to find cancer and less false positives. So all around, a much better tool for deciding who should be screened for lung cancer.
And your thought on the likelihood that these particular guidelines will be adopted?
We're trying to not screen everybody, but to screen the individuals that are most at risk. Now we are refining things. This could be incorporated into a computer program that you could go online, type in all this stuff, and it gives you an idea of whether you should be screened or not. So I think there's a very high likelihood we can incorporate this into our practice.
Well, we know, of course, that in the lungs, there's a particularly high likelihood that there are going to be lesions identified. I mean, even people who don't smoke get lesions in their lungs.
And this risk model lowers the risk that there will be false positives. A lot of upside in this particular study.
Win-win. Sounds like this is something we need to do with all screening tests, I would offer.
I agree with you.
Finally, then, something that I thought was really quite interesting. In circulation, silent MI, myocardial infarction, or heart attack.
Most of the time when we talk about an MI or a heart attack, we talk about the symptoms that people describe. But silent MI is people that have had a heart attack and didn't know it. So your perspective on this study, and we'll talk about the details after.
I'm just amazed. I had no idea that there was such a high rate of this going on.
So specifically what this study did was, we've had this long-term study going on since 1986 or 7 called the Atherosclerosis Risk and Community, the ERIC trial. We have data since 1987. People were first examined then, and every 2 or 3 years, followed for 4 times. We have data on people that at the first time did not have a heart attack, followed up till about 2010. And what they discovered was, of all the heart attacks, about 45% of them were silent. Therefore, they never received treatment from their physician afterwards. And we know that this secondary treatment, like aspirin and statins, can reduce the risk. Their risk over the next several years of having a complication was about as high as people that had heart attack with symptoms. It was more likely for African Americans to have a silent heart attack than Caucasians. Women had a worse outcome than men once they had a silent myocardial infarction. So, as you said, the incidence is pretty high. The prognosis is guarded.
And I would just guess, and of course, we don't have real data on this, but I wonder how contributory this is to the ultimate development of other cardiac conditions down the road, like congestive heart failure.
Exactly, because once someone's had a heart attack, they're more likely to either have another heart attack or to have congestive heart failure, and more likely to have a stroke and atrial fibrillation. That's why it's important to recognize it.
Exactly. So now that we've determined that, wow, there's a lot of this going on that we didn't know about, it's got a number of deleterious outcomes, what can we do about it?
We certainly know what risk factors are associated with things like diabetes and obesity, high blood pressure and high cholesterol. So those are individuals, they're in my practice and they don't complain about symptoms. I still think they need to undergo routine evaluation, which at the minimum would include an electrocardiogram. The other thing is I think we need to do some additional studies trying to assess what the gender and race differences are and how we need to approach these individuals.
More studies needed. On that note, I think this week on the blog, I'm going to talk about the knee osteoarthritis and the Tai Chi. Boy, am I vested in that personally? That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.